Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We have a very, very sad sad announcement. Ima Mays, one of our wonderful moderators at Web Sleuths, we all love and adore her. Her father just passed a few moments ago. She just called us. He was 75. His name was Wally. And we just wanted to tell Ima Mays that we love her and we're very sorry. We're dedicating the show tonight to Wally, because he has such a great daughter in Ima Mays. So keep Ima Mays' family in your thoughts and prayers. Our guest tonight, Andy Kahn. Andy Kahn is a victims' rights advocate for the Houston Police Department. And according to Wikipedia, he coined the phrase murderabilia. Stephen Wilkins, whose sister Katie was found dead in her garage, and at the center of this whole story, is the son of the president of Pepperdine University. And Stephen Wilkins is not getting the answers, the help or support he needs, and it appears the powers that be are perhaps thwarting the truth. We're going to talk to Stephen Wilkins about this. Later in the show, Mark Klass will join us to talk about Isabel Celis, and we'll also discuss Trayvon Martin. And joining us for the whole flipping darn show, as we say in Utah, Levi Page. I hope Levi has called in. I'm not sure if he has. Kimster, has Levi called in yet?
I haven't seen him yet. Levi, where are you?
Little stinker. I'll have to text him here while we're trying to talk. So let's see. Kimster, why don't you go ahead and call him? Do you have his number handy?
Yes, I'll call him right now. You don't worry about that.
Say, where the heck are you, you goof? Okay. All right, here's the deal. We got some legal stuff we have to say right off the bat, and that is the opinions on Web Sleuths Radio are those of the hosts and the guests only. And, of course, I take no responsibility for them. WebSleuths.com LLC is a completely different and separate corporate entity from Web Sleuths Radio. Web Sleuths Radio stands on its own. In other words, just because it's on Web Sleuths Radio does not mean WebSleuths.com condones it or has anything to do with it whatsoever. Okay, I need you all to think about something. And this goes to the posters out there, people who've posted on the internet before. Think about this. How many times have you run across a new poster who just will not look at the facts of the case? I mean, you have put it down is in as simple as a form as you possibly can, and they still argue with you. You have to wonder if they have an agenda, or are they just dense, paid posters? Is there such a thing? Well, there most certainly is. There are public relations firms who are very proud to tell you one of their selling points is the fact they have an army of people who will try and help sway public opinion about their clients by posting on discussion boards. Web Sleuth is one of the most influential and largest true crime discussion boards out there. Do we have paid posters? Not that I'm aware of, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of the more powerful people who are involved in crime will try and sway public opinion by hiring one of these public relations firms, and they have perhaps posted on Web Sleuth. It could have happened. I wouldn't be surprised if it did. However, if I ever found anyone who was a paid poster, I would ban them in a heartbeat, and I'm sure my business partner, co-owner of Web Sleuths, and good friend Sue would agree wholeheartedly. Why do I bring this up? Well, because once again, I've been accused of being paid off. I can't tell you how many times I've been accused of being paid off. You know what? It just doesn't happen. I am not being paid off to do anything. I would never take money to sway a case. It's laughable. And the problem is this. The Trayvon Martin case has been so, it's just divided people, it has cost friendships, and let me tell you, I want to assure you that both sides of the argument, whether you believe Trayvon was murdered by George Zimmerman, or whether you believe George Zimmerman was acting in self-defense, both sides constantly come to me and complain that I'm letting the other side get away with too much. It's nonstop complaints. Kimster can tell you, anybody who works on Web Sleuths can tell you, both sides are very upset that I am, quote, letting the other side get away with everything. And of course, whenever there is a case like this, then the ugliness rears its head and I get accused of all kinds of things. I just want to assure you, it is not the case, nor has it ever been the case. It would be something I wouldn't even think of, I would never even consider, and it's ridiculous to even suggest. So remember this, I'm irritating everybody on both sides of the discussion. That means we're doing our job right on Web Sleuths. Okay, our guest tonight, we have some very, very interesting people. Andy Kahn is our first guest. A little bit later on, we are going to talk with Steve Wilkins, and then later Mark Klass will join us, and hopefully Levi Page. But first, let's go to Andy Kahn. Andy is the victim's advocate for the city of Houston. Keeps him extremely busy. You should read his bio. It is amazing the things Andy has done. I'm just going to start with 1993, creating a capital offense for those who murder a child 6 years and younger. 1993, reduction in the amount of parolees released in Harris County. 95, abolishment of mandatory release of convicted felons. And the list goes on and on. These are all things that Andy Kahn has been involved with. And Andy, welcome to the show tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things. Well, many things, actually. You started out in this whole situation because as a parole officer, you saw things that you said sickened you. Tell us what brought you to this this victim's advocate, this fire in your belly you have for the victims and their rights. What did you see as a parole officer that caused you to turn around and fight back?
Well, basically, we were having a big problem in Houston in the late 80s with overcrowding and early release, and I was what's called a parole hearing officer, where we made recommendations to send convicted felons back to prison when they had committed another crime. Now, call me crazy, but I was of the opinion that if you were on parole and you committed a new offense, you should probably go back to prison. But a lot of my recommendations were being overturned, and some of the recommendations that were overturned, they went on to further basically continue their criminal career. In one case particular, we had a four-time burglar who was an absconder, who was convicted of theft, who failed to report. I recommended he go back to prison. They overruled my recommendation. They released him. And then about a month later, while in the commission of yet another burglary, he killed an 80-year-old woman. And I knew this should have never happened. So, frankly, a long story in a nutshell, I went public on a little-known show called CBS's 48 Hours, and I released a three-page document that essentially spelled out how many inmates had to be released weekly, monthly, and on a daily basis, no matter what their status was. In 1990, about 8 out of every 10 parole-eligible inmate in the state of Texas was being released, and you can imagine what it was doing to the streets of Houston. So I guess I just kind of blew the whistle on early releases and went public. And what happened was, in a strange twist of fate, in 1991, the mayor's race, crime was the issue. I had been doing volunteer work with organizations such as Parents of Murdered Children, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and was essentially known as a straight shooter, which back then was almost unheard of, from having somebody within the criminal justice system to actually be telling victims accurate and correct information instead of just telling them what they might want to hear and telling them, shoo, go by. Well, this particular candidate had met with several organizations and asked what he could do to help them, and they asked for a staff person out of the mayor's office to address victims' rights and public safety issues, and this particular candidate agreed. He was elected. I was recommended for this position, and one of the great interviews of all time, the chief of staff of the mayor said, I haven't the faintest idea what you're supposed to do, so do what you think you need to do and see you. So it's
wow.
Very rare in life that you get an opportunity to build something from the ground floor, and also they couldn't give you a nice little manual to read and say, here's the manual, or could they say, call New York, L.A., or Chicago? So that's where it began. My staff consists of me. We get along real well. They're very subservient. And I recognized a long time ago, anybody can yell and scream about the injustices of the world. I would much prefer to find a solution and or a remedy. So I concentrated a lot of my efforts on seeking legislative changes. When we find a glitch in the criminal justice system, that's great. We found something, a glitch. Now let's do something to fix it. So that's what I do.
And you do it amazingly well. I was reading some information about you on the internet, And I don't know how you do it. You do the work of 10 people, if not more. What do you feel is the biggest change that has come about, let's say, in the past 10 years with victims' rights? Because it seems like there is a swell that starts, and it goes across the country. And you do lead the charge many a times when it comes in to victims' rights. We're talking with Andy Kahn. And Andy, what do you see as the biggest and best change that has happened so far?
I think victims recognize that they have a voice in the system and they have a say-so in what happens with their cases, and they just don't have to meekly go along with whatever's happening. So, you have this advent of advocates like myself and others throughout the country to make sure that their due process, their rights, their well-being is being taken care of. So you have advocates in law enforcement, you have advocates in corrections, so you have people now that are within these entities looking out and making sure that victims are being treated with dignity and respect.
You were instrumental in getting a law passed, or at least an amendment, to where victims were able to stand up in court and speak to the killer of their loved ones and to attend their executions. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And again, that stemmed from the same case. And there's a great book, if you want to read, anybody want to read, it's called Pure Murder. One of the most horrific cases that I've ever been involved with, and this was two young girls that were basically ambushed, tortured, and killed by a bunch of gang members, and it was just absolutely horrific what happened to these two young girls. Five of the defendants were subsequently sentenced to the death penalty in the state of Texas, and one juvenile got 40 years. Of the five, two were subsequently removed from death row by the U.S. Supreme Court, that determined that 17-year-olds don't know you're not supposed to kill anybody. Mm-hmm. But one of the fathers in the hallway, he just asked me, you know, I'd really like to be there when they execute these guys. Can I do that? And trust me, he didn't say it so politely or cleanly.
Right.
I probably cleaned the entire sentence up for him. And I found out that time victims' families were specifically prohibited by policy. And from my perspective, if inmates' families, friends, and relatives were allowed to be present, quid pro quo. So we actually pursued it as a civil rights issue. It took us 2 years. I had no idea, you know, how many people would take advantage of it. But our position was that victims' families should be able to decide for themselves whether they want to be present at the execution of the person that murdered one of their loved ones. And about 75% of families in the state of Texas have opted to be present. Mm-hmm. For the record, I have been up to 7 executions with victims' families. It is the most mentally draining, grueling, emotional day you would never want to experience.
What does a family feel after they see the execution? Does it really help, or does it just make it worse?
Well, I can tell you from a first-person vantage of actually having been there, and I love, you know, watching some of the talking heads talk about that it doesn't do anything. I'll tell you, the ones that I've been up to, it means a great deal. I literally saw actual face color returned to one particular father who was so robotic for many years, and I'll never forget the day of the execution. I've never seen this man laugh before, but he literally almost turned back into a human being the day after. One mother put it very succinctly to me, and she said, you know what this means? I'm done with the criminal justice system. Over and done with. I don't have to worry about any phone calls, no technicalities, no overturns, no nothing. I can go to my daughter's grave and tell her that justice was served. So for these families, it's not the word closure that the media loves to give a tagline to. What it is, it's a chapter in that life book that's done with.
It's done, and that is very interesting. They're done with the criminal justice system. Obviously, you are a big proponent of the death penalty. I personally feel that I'm for the death penalty because there are people out there that will kill no matter what, and the only way that we can be sure that they will never kill again is by killing them. It is barbaric, but it works. And until we can figure out a different way, I think that's the only way we can do it. However, do you really find that the death penalty is a deterrent? Because, damn, it seems like there's a lot of first-degree murders going on in Texas.
Let me put it this way, and I get asked, let me put, do you think, do DWI laws prevent people from drinking and driving?
No.
Okay, so why do we give a special status? It is a punishment, plain and simple, reserved for some of the most horrific, diabolical, cold-blooded crimes known to mankind. That's really what it is. It, you know, if you want to label it as a deterrent, so be it. If you want to label it as not a deterrent, so be it. That's really what it's about. Do I want to credit the fact that the amount of homicides in Houston dropped, you know, over 50%? Do I want to credit the death penalty? No.
What would you credit?
I would credit just a combination of factors. You have a lot more law enforcement. You have also medical. The fact that, you know, you have a tremendous amount of more medical skills that keep people alive that years ago wouldn't be alive as well. So to me, you know, quite simple, the death penalty is what it is. If it serves as a deterrent to some, so be it. If it doesn't, I don't believe it deserves a special status.
I don't know if you've ever heard Ron White, the comedian, but he proudly states that Texas is putting in an express lane in the death penalty issues, in the death sentences for people on death row in Texas, meaning you don't get a whole lot of appeals like you used to, people used to on death row. It's not like California, where you're more than likely will die of old age.
Well,
rather,
California, you know, death penalty, you know, quite frankly, is a farce. How many executions in the state of California?
I think there's one a year, maybe.
Maybe. You know, in Texas, trust me, the appellate process is quite thorough. There's a lot of I's and T's that are dotted. There's a lot of different courts that look through these cases. And generally, you're looking at spending anywhere from at least over 8 to 10 years on death row before you even see an execution date. So it's not a so-called assembly line process.
I have one more question, and then we'll get off this topic.
Sure.
What about the people who have been released from death row because they've been cleared by DNA? Now, granted, just because the DNA didn't match doesn't necessarily mean they were involved in the crime. But I'm talking about the ones where it was rape and the rape DNA doesn't match the person, and that person is released from death row. What do you feel about that? Doesn't that make you hesitant about the death penalty?
If there's a rape, there also has to be a murder. You don't get the death penalty.
Well, I understand. That's what I mean. Yes, absolutely.
Right.
That's what I mean, a rape and a murder. But doesn't that make you hesitant about the death penalty at all?
A lot of these cases that people have been so-called exonerated from death row happened in the 80s, where you didn't have the tools that we have right now. So, I think the death penalty goes in cycles. Frankly, from my perspective, I really wouldn't be shocked if you saw the death penalty abolished in the next few years. Would it bother me? No.
It wouldn't? Why?
No, absolutely not. As long as they're locked up behind bars for life, then they're not going to get out, and you have assurances of that. The only problem that you have from a victim's perspective is, how do you ensure that that policy is going to be there 20 years later, that different branches of the government aren't going to change that where there's a possibility of parole?
That's the problem. We're talking with Andy Kahn, and Andy has done many, many amazing things in his life. He is a victims advocate for the city of Houston, and he works with about 10 people, and they're all himself. He does everything, and he has gotten so many laws changed and removed and new laws put on the books, all to help victims' families. Let's talk about that. Mark Klass and I have spoken about this at great length, and he'll be on the show a little bit later. That's the problem with life in prison. It doesn't really mean life, because things can change. And how do you make it so life in prison is life in prison? What can you do? You can
you're seeing that right now with the juveniles that got life without parole for committing some heinous crimes as well, and a push to make them parole eligible after they serve a certain year. So, it's a way to really chip away, and that's what we're concerned about.
And what can we do, though? I mean, I guess you could put – is there such a thing as an ironclad law that can never be changed? I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, unfortunately, you know, laws are changed, and if they are changed, they're usually changed retroactively on behalf of convicted criminals and never retroactively on behalf of crime victims. That's what we find.
It's kind of an
oxymoron.
I understand.
Let me tell you my favorite saying is that criminal justice and logic are oxymoronic terms that often have difficult times meeting each other.
But that I believe. Andy, what is, give us an example of a horrible miscarriage of justice that you have seen as a victim's advocate, and perhaps what we can do to change it or to make that from, to prevent that from happening ever again.
Well, one of the things that we constantly battle, particularly in the state of Texas, is we had a law called mandatory release law. And a mandatory release law was passed to help alleviate prison overcrowding, and it gave inmates, including all violent offenders, the opportunity to accumulate good time credits towards their release. For example, we have a very infamous serial killer called the Nurse Baby Killer by the name of Janine Jones, who is
credited. I know. I shouldn't say I know her, but I've studied up on her quite a bit. What a crazy, sick woman.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Are you aware that by statute, she will be legally released somewhere around the year 2017? No ifs, ands, or buts. She will walk out that door, even though she got 99 years in 1984. She will be one of the first serial killers ever legally released in this country's history, and there's not a thing we can do about it.
Oh, my God.
We had another serial killer by the name of Coral Eugene Watts, who killed 13 Houston area women in 1981-82, is credited with over 40 murders, homicide. He's the nation's most prolific serial killer that probably no one ever heard about. He, too, would have been out the door on mandatory release if a few of us hadn't got together and got involved and finally got him charged on another case in 1979 out of Michigan.
Out of Michigan, so I remember that, right.
It's absolutely an amazing story because no one gave us a snowball's chance to prevent this person from getting out.
He did a murder in Michigan. There was one eyewitness, if I remember correctly. He was going to get out, and he was a scary serial killer, killing, you know, strangers.
He was
and
a diabolical killing machine that killed all races, all ages, all socioeconomic backgrounds.
You guys found this other case in Michigan where you were able to get the state of Michigan to bring first-degree murder charges against him, brought forward this eyewitness, and thank God the jury gave him life in prison, and that was no possibility of parole. There's no chance there, right?
That's correct. He actually died in a Michigan prison a few years ago of prostate cancer.
Well, that's
but his words when they let him out of the courtroom was, you know, if they ever release me, I'm going to do it again. Mm. It was the most amazing campaign that I've ever been part of, and it was truly amounts to the fact that nobody, what a small group of people can do when they put their mind to it.
And
we
exactly.
It's the state law. He's getting out. Nothing you can do about it. So we just decided, you know what? If we're going to legally release a serial killer, we're going to go down kicking, screaming, fighting, and the whole world's going to know. And luckily, we did a huge media blitz, kept this story alive, and that's how the eyewitness came forward. He watched the news report on it.
And he went, I recognize that guy. That was an amazing story.
I'll never forget that.
Now, Janine Jones, she was a nurse or a nurse's aide.
She was a nurse.
And she worked at a pediatric office with a doctor. And these babies, she would smother them and try and bring them back to life. And there were times she couldn't, and she killed them. She is a serial killer. Can we do the same thing? When I say we, I mean you, obviously. Can the same thing be done with Janine Jones as was done with the first case with the serial killer? Can you do a media blitz? Can we get out there?
We're going to do everything we possibly can. The only problematic, from my perspective, I don't really think there's any case out there.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Watts, we knew there were other murders that we could possibly connect him to.
Right.
Just to witnesses. We'll do the same thing with this one and hope that we strike gold again.
But this is
pretty scary thoughts. You have a lot of violent offenders who have maxed out their time because of some archaic, outdated laws that were passed by a multitude of states to help alleviate prison overcrowding. And they're going to come back and bite you down the road.
It really is. And she's one of them. Andy Kahn, we are talking with Andy Kahn. He is the victims advocate in Houston. And Andy, according to Wikipedia, and this is very, very fascinating, you coined the term murderabilia. Tell us about that. What is it, and what are you involved with it? Are you involved in it in any way, shape, or form?
It's the strangest project I've ever been involved with in almost 30-plus years of being involved in the criminal justice system. I discovered a burgeoning online industry, particularly being promoted on eBay, the world's largest internet auction site, that was selling items procured by convicted serial killers and high-profile murders by third parties simply to make a buck off. So I made this word up to kind of describe this macabre, insidious industry. And we had, I was stunned that it was legal. I couldn't believe that some of these people who committed some of these most horrific crimes could ship out their artwork, their letters, their autograph, mundane items, including their hair, parts of their clothing, and anything that they could have attached to themselves that they could actually produce themselves would be sold for profit. And there were no, it was legal. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the eBay PR person of, you know, he got to know me real well for the next few years, and he just said, you know, we're not the morality police. As long as it's legal, we have an obligation to offer it. You don't like it, you do something about it. And I just went, okay. So I was going to take this industry on and started doing a lot of research. Actually, your guest a little bit later on the show, Mark Klass, I actually contacted Mark a couple of years down the road and got him involved in passing a law in California called the Notoriety for Profit Law, because we found that Richard Allen Davis, who murdered his daughter Polly, had items such as him being shirtless in the San Quentin prison yard and letters that mm-hmm. were sold for profit. And I can't tell you how disgusted Mark was, but you can pretty much
imagine. Yeah.
His reaction when he found that out. The problem that I discovered was most people were under the false delusion that we have what's called Son of Sam laws. Son mm-hmm. of Sam laws do not exist, period. Here's a little known fact that most people are not aware of. Son of Sam laws were ruled unconstitutional by a little known court known as the United States Supreme Court in 1991 in a case involving Simon & Schuster and a mafia informant by the name of Henry Hill. Henry Hill.
Oh, I'm very familiar with
listeners.
Henry.
Is the lead character in Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, New York sued Simon & Schuster under the Son of Sam law, claiming that they shouldn't be allowed to receive proceeds, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, who ruled in favor of Simon & Schuster. The problem with Son of Sam laws is they had language that deals with restricting free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Most courts frown on anything that restricts free speech. So what I started doing was crafting what we call notoriety for profit laws, meaning you can talk all you want, paint, scratch, write, whatever, you just don't make money off of it. So
right.
We have about 8 states that have passed what's called notoriety for profit laws, meaning you can't profit from anything that you have done or you've producing associated with some of these criminal activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a federal bill that we hope to get refiled as well, because really that's the only way you're really going to put a dent to this insidious industry.
Where does that stand? Where does that bill stand now?
Nowhere.
Nowhere.
The problem that I ran into is I can't enforce the Texas law when a Florida dealer is selling items. It's unenforceable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Same thing, because frankly, for the most part, you're dealing with interstate commerce. Items are being shipped out via U.S. mail across state lines to 7 dealers who sell on websites all over the country. You have
mm-hmm.
websites such as Murder Auction, Serial Killers Inc., Ghouls Like Us, Dark Vomit, Red Rum Autographs. There are about 7 national dealers
mm-hmm.
that procure items for high-profile killers simply to make a buck off of it. And from
what
a victim's perspective, It's the most nauseating and disgusting thing to find out the person who murdered one of your loved ones now has items being hawked by third parties.
Mm-hmm. And they're making money off of it. What I think is interesting is, is how in the world can the person confirm that it really is something from the serial killer? It just seems like you could get ripped off so easily, which doesn't bother me at all because, you know, this to me is just so disgusting. Can you imagine Richard Allen Davis? And I know our listeners will remember him, the murder of Polly Klass, the killer of Polly Klass, one of the most disgusting, vile individuals on the planet. And he is making money because he killed Polly Klass because some sicko wants to buy something from him. It's just appalling. And I don't think, Andy, I don't think people realize what a big business it is. Am I right?
No, you're absolutely correct. It's a growing industry. I've seen several internet websites pop up over the past year that are now selling murderabilia as well. So we have to ask ourselves as a society, you know, I'm a firm believer in free enterprise and capitalism, mm-hmm. but I think you got to draw the line somewhere. And you
right.
just shouldn't be able to rob, rape, and murder and then turn around and make a buck off of it. It's really that simplistic. So we have a federal bill, believe it or not, that's been filed not once but twice, and we've never even had a hearing on it. I can't, for life of me, have never been able to figure this one out because it's about as nonpartisan as an issue as you could possibly get.
Exactly. Oh, but yeah, you can't. Who would defend some serial killer making money? What's the most bizarre thing that you have seen for sale by a killer?
I've actually produced a top 10 most bizarre item list.
Oh, do you have it? Can you read it?
I can read you some of it just from the top of my head, just because I know it just verbatim. Easily number one was the only way you could describe it would be sexually bodily fluid. I can't write this material. I can't make this stuff up. So if you want, I'll continue.
I need to
your own imagination.
Well, I need to ask some questions here because let's face it, I'm going to ask the questions that everybody's thinking, but they don't want to ask because they're too embarrassed, and nothing embarrasses
sure.
me. So first of all, who was it and how much did it go for? And do you know who bought it? Three questions.
Well, I know one person who bought it because I have it, because I do national workshops and lectures on this issue, and I actually felt it was important when I started doing the research on this to have items in my actual possession that I could present to elected officials and interested parties to show them exactly what was going on.
Exactly. So about it. Who was the person who was the criminal?
It was a Massachusetts school shooter by the name of Wayne Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
And he disputes what the seller was actually selling, so, you know, you can read into whatever on that. But the other ones that I've seen was foot scrapings from the railway killer, Angel Resendez Ramirez. That's as pretty disgusting as you can get. Lawrence Bittaker, better known as Pliers, and his partner Roy Norris actually produced victim maps where they killed and buried and in some cases threw some of their victims off a cliff. They actually had maps. They would actually produce. Some seller years back was selling dirt from the crawl space where John Wayne Gacy buried his victims.
And people were buying
it? There were 28 people bidding on this. I'll never forget that one.
28 people bidding on it. That is absolutely disgusting.
Charles Manson, one of the biggest wheeler and dealers, had his used cigarettes up for sale. Manson is a big seller of his hair. Usually that is sold in the form of a swastika. And then last year, one of the dealers, and I've seen a lot, and this was about as low as I've seen, he actually went in a very high-profile case of a victim by the name of James Byrd Jr., better known as the victim of the Jasper Dragon death. Three white supremacists dragging his desk on high. This particular dealer went to Byrd's grave, scooped up dirt, and put it up for sale, along with rocks and pavement from the highway that Byrd was dragged to death. That was about as low as I've ever seen.
Holy mother of God, please tell me nobody bid on it.
No, we really took it to task on that, and there was a lot of outrage and, of course, a lot of press coverage on that as well, and he ended up yanking the items down himself. And I was very hopeful and very actually pretty disturbed because I was trying to get him charged with theft. because I'm sorry, if you go to somebody's grave and you take something from someone's grave and you put it up for sale, at least in my mind, that constitutes theft.
Absolutely.
But I couldn't get the DA to do anything on that case. So anything, there's a cross-dressing transvestite serial killer by the name of Haddon Clark.
I remember
in
him.
In Maryland. And luckily, we don't have too many of those.
Yes,
as far as recorded. He'll, anything that he gets his hand on, he'll ship out his toothbrushes, his deodorant, his soap, his undergarments, and they're all for sale. There's one California serial killer named Dana Sue Gray that has her signed panties for sale right now.
Good Lord.
So,
it's the most
macabre industry I've ever seen.
And it is, you've just got to wonder who are buying, what is the mindset of the person buying it? I've got to think that it's young kids just being stupid. I would hope it's just something like that. And when they get older, they'll be mortified at their behavior. I pray that's it. Because I would hate to see.
Like it or not, there's a small group of people out there that idolize serial killers and high-profile killers. And when you think about it in perspective, let's take A&E Network, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Who do they do bios of?
Well, serial killers, sure.
They do a serial killer man. You ever seen them do a bio of a crime victim?
No.
No. But they take these killers, they turn them into household words. They're the ones who the movies are made of, the books are made of. They become immortalized and given infamy that they richly don't deserve.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only dealing with the murder billy industry, but also the entertainment industry that seems to thrive on murder.
Oh, that is just, you have just opened my eyes to something that I didn't want to see, but I guess we have to. It's out there. What can we do if we come upon one of these sites? I mean, we can't harass the person, but is there something we can do?
Yeah, you can. You can contact your congressman and your senator.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
And ask him to get behind and get this bill reintroduced again. It's called the Federal Anti-Murder Billionaire Crime Victim Dignity Act. It was sponsored by Texas Senator John Cornyn, a Republican, and co-sponsored by Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat.
Andy, could you send that to me, and we'll get it up on Web Sleuths, because that would be great. Andy Kahn, do you have a website or somewhere we can direct people to go to learn more about you and learn about what you do and maybe take some of the things that you have done and take it to their own states?
The best thing, if you want to see what's going on, is Google me or Facebook me. Facebook's become an incredible tool for me to get a lot of these issues out and information out, not just locally but nationally to a conglomerate of victim advocates, and that's how we stay in touch on this as well. And then anybody can email me as well.
Spell your name, because it's a little bit different spelling.
Yes, that it is. I have many, many different spellings, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
My first name, obviously, is A-N-D-Y, and then my last name is K-A-H-A-N.
K-A-H-A-N. There you go. Yep. Andy Kahn, thank you so much. You are an amazing man. You're an incredible person to have on the side of victims. I've heard about you from several people for a long time. And finally, somebody wrote me and said, when are you going to have Andy Kahn on? I'm going to have him on this weekend. So thank you so much, victims advocate for the city of Houston, the man who coined the term murderabilia and has done all kinds of things to get that sick, twisted type of market closed down. Andy Kahn, thank you so much. You're welcome to stay on the line. We're going to be talking with Steve Wilkins here in a little bit, and we'll have Mark Klass on. So I will leave it totally up to you, Andy, and you're welcome to jump in as well, okay?
I appreciate it. You bet.
Thank you so much. Steve Wilkins. Steve, welcome to Web Sleuths Radio.
Hey, Tricia. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Steve's sister, Katie, died. It was very tragic. Young woman, incredible woman. But there are so many questions surrounding her death. The problem is the person who was with her when she more than likely died isn't talking. And he just happens to be the son of the president of Pepperdine University. Okay, Steve, tell us the story. Give us the beginning, the middle, and the end, where you are right now and what is going on with the investigation into the death of your sister, Katie.
Okay, yeah. First, I did want to say thoughts go out to Wally's family. You mentioned he passed away recently. So
Thank you.
The hint is, with my sister Katie Wilkins, yeah, you know, I was going up to my parents' house to kind of check on her. She was home alone for a weekend. She's 25 years old. And in my trip up to just check in on her, the front door was locked, and I opened that up, and I walked into the house to find the door leading to the garage wide open, and that was kind of the first signifier that something was out of place.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked in that door, I saw her on the ground. It looked to me initially like she had passed out. I went over to her, and I had felt her, and she was cold, and I realized right away that she was dead. Now, at that moment, I think I was in shock. I certainly was. Shortly after that, when authorities came by, you know, I realized her car was missing. And, you know, there was a lot of suspicious evidence surrounding her death to try and build what had happened to her. How did she die in that garage? Did she die in the garage, or was she put there? Who had that car? What was the cause of death? All these answers. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of those answers were in the air for a few days until the investigation revealed that this gentleman, Christopher Benton, was the last known person to be with my sister, Katie Wilkins. He is the son of President of Pepperdine University.
Okay.
President Andy Benton. And there is it is an important piece of the puzzle here, because Chris has not said a word to investigators or to my family to help shed some light on what happened that night.
Now, how do you know? Let me stop you right here. How do you know he was with her?
We know he was with her because after Katie's death, I was able to get into her cell phone. Investigators were with my help to unlock her password there. And we saw a series of text messages between Katie and Chris indicating a meeting the night before her death. The text indicated they were meeting at the McDonald's in Malibu. We went down to the McDonald's in Malibu to scope the surveillance video there. And sure enough, we saw the gentleman, who was certainly Chris Benton, getting into Katie's car, and just the two of them driving away from McDonald's just hours before she passed away. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, we went after him to try and ask him some questions. He was not a suspect at this time, but he did choose to hire a lawyer, which indicates that he feared, you know, prosecution should more evidence come forward.
What is he afraid of, exactly?
What is he afraid of? Why not, if he has any information in this case, which would be hugely beneficial to me and my family, why not come forward with it? Why hire a lawyer?
A decent human being who has a conscience.
Yeah, yeah.
Would say, oh, my God, I was with her. She, you know, A, B, and C happened, or I left and she was fine. I am so sorry. Let me help you. I miss her, too. A decent human being with a heart would do
that. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. A decent human being, someone who was not culpable here, would have come forward. The investigation should not have had to reveal him. And if it did, he should have come forward. Just as you said, here's what happened. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Mm-hmm.
My thoughts with your family, but he has been protected through this lawyer and through the rehab, and it also appears to me like his father was complicit in those actions, because Chris's messages indicate that he was living at home. It indicates he had no steady job, so you have to wonder, how did he afford these protective means? How did he afford a highly regarded lawyer who specializes in criminal drug cases and murders? How did he afford getting into rehab? And it goes beyond what I'm willing to give his father, Andy, credit for, to assume that Chris did these actions without his father's knowledge or without his mm-hmm. father's complicit financial, you know, help there.
Exactly.
So it's been really tough, and all my family and I was looking for was just some answers here. When Chris was revealed and he took these actions, it was this huge roadblock. And we've been inundated with all these questions to what really went on here. And we're really trying to push for him to be questioned. But because in Katie's case there was a no foul play ruling fairly quickly, that has really been a roadblock for investigators to have an avenue to pursue questioning Chris.
Joining us now is Steve Wilkins. Steve's sister Katie died, and she was in the presence of the president of Pepperdine University's son, Chris Benton. Is that correct? Do I have his name correct?
That's correct. Christopher Benton, son of Andy Benton.
son of Andy Benton, and because, let's face it, because of Chris's father, the status and the power he has, he's been able to put up roadblocks and be able to stop any questioning. Now, when you say that Katie's death was ruled, what exactly was it ruled? What did they say she died from?
Well, they don't know what she died from at this point. It's an interesting topic. There was an official no foul play ruling just a few days after she died. And the no foul play ruling is largely built on her past drug use issues. Now, she's been clean from hard drugs since 2009, but I have to believe that her past drug use is what led to the no foul play ruling, which has, in a sick way, kept Chris covered in the shield he's put up so far, because that protects him from being questioned. But the no foul play ruling is really contingent on the fact that Katie has had drug abuse issues in her past, not present, not leading up to her death, but in her past, and there was no signs of obvious struggle. My questions to that are, she was found dead, she was left there, her car was missing, the needle marks were in her right arm, she's right-handed, no one ever came forward. So there's all these suspicious pieces added to her past drug abuse. So why a no foul play ruling that appears to me to only be based on her past drug use, and not considering that the tox isn't back in yet, the fingerprint report's not back in yet, her last known contact, Chris Benton, has not been questioned yet, and he's certainly taken actions that indicate he's really worried about being prosecuted here should he have to come forward. So it's been frustrating. I don't know the legal process through and through. I'm certainly looking for help in understanding how this has gone through to its point so far. The investigators have been great. The law enforcement have been great. But it really does appear that this no foul play ruling, which was perhaps largely contingent on her past drug abuse, has helped enable Chris's actions to be successful and just his ability to be protected from having to come forward and reveal what he knows. There was certainly somebody with Katie, and it appears, if you follow the facts to a logical conclusion, that Chris was that person. What was he doing there? Why did he flee? And why hasn't he been questioned?
Enabled. That is the word here, enabled. Law enforcement's ruling of no foul play in your sister's death has enabled the son of the university president of Pepperdine University to hide and to not have to worry about saying anything or explaining any of his actions or what happened with he and Katie that night. And that's frustrating because, like you said, it was because of her drug use. I mean, let's face it, the cops, how many times do they see drug addicts, whether they're clean or not, die of a drug overdose? It's how they jump to a conclusion. And I can understand it. I don't accept it, but I understand it because it's like they see it all the time. However, it is so unfair and so wrong to do that with any case, because you just never know. You say Katie's car was missing. Has it been found yet?
Her car has been found. It was found 11 days after she was found dead. They're still doing print reports on that. I'm certain they'll find his prints in the car. We just need to figure out where he was and how many times he was there on that wheel or not.
Exactly.
We're still waiting for that information to come in. And your point there in terms of how frustrating it is in this past drug use being a fact that was right on the point there, I can understand it, but I don't accept it. You know, there's other things at play here. There's questions that need to be answered, and the past drug abuse should not be a quick route out here to alleviate answering those questions. Those need to be asked. They need to be figured out.
And the other thing that they need to look at is, what was the relationship between Katie and Chris Benton? What was going on? Was there arguing going on? Was there something deep and dark?
Was there sexual stuff going on?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is his past? Has he been around other people before who have died mysteriously? Has Daddy protected him? And that's the thing that just gets me so riled up, is that Daddy would... all the money. You know damn well if it was one of us, we wouldn't be able to do that. And the cops would be right in our face, as they should, you know. But because of Daddy's money, this spoiled little kid keeps getting away with all kinds of whatever we don't know, because he's not being allowed to talk. He looks guilty, and it looks bad for him to do this to your family. And what a horrible, horrible thing to do to your family. The president of Pepperdine University should be absolutely ashamed of his behavior and his son's behavior. He should be mortified. A president of a university should have more dignity and more honesty in them and come forward and offer to help. Now, Chris Benton is a recovering drug addict, as you mentioned. You also mentioned that Katie had needle tracks in her right arm, but she was right-handed, so that would be impossible. You know, I mean, it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be
very unlikely, yes,
right,
that she was the one who administered that. Perhaps when tox come back, the fatal drug overdose, we don't know what it was yet. We don't know if it was heroin, if it was a mix of things, or if she was complicit in that action or not. We just don't know. We really think Chris has those answers, and we are. We feel so much shame towards him and that family for doing what they've done to us.
Mm-hmm.
Just come forward, make him available, answer some of these questions that we really need to know, we deserve to know, we expect to know.
Exactly. And as a parent, you need to teach your kids that, guess what, I'll stand behind you and I will help you, but if you have done something wrong, you need to suffer the consequences and take what's coming to you. You need to be honest and stand up and do the right thing. That doesn't mean you abandon your children. That doesn't mean that you say, oh, I'm just going to let you wallow away in prison if they've done something illegal. But by God, you stand up and you make them face their actions, because if you don't, they're going to be like this their whole life. Now, Steve, you
absolutely
came to...
And what happens when Chris goes out there again?
I really think
that in Katie's condition, a phone call could have possibly saved her life, could have likely saved her life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Chris, for whatever reason, felt, or the person with her, we think it was Chris, you know, had an ability to not make that call because maybe he thought about this cover he could engage in. What happens the next time he's out there with somebody when somebody needs help and he has to show some character and he runs and hides?
And that's what he will.
There's a concern there that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He will. And that's just it. The character there is lacking. And his
absolutely
father is complicit in this, and he is the president of the university. That is what is so frustrating. Steve Wilkins, you came to Web Sleuths and started posting about your sister's case. What can we do as a forum, as a group, as a very powerful group when we put our minds to it? What can we do to help you?
Well, first of all, I have to think that I did not start the thread there. I actually was posting in a few blogs about my known information regarding Katie's death, just trying to get this story out there. Hey, guys, this is what we know. Katie died, the last kid with her, enacted this cover plan through the help of his father. It's not right. And there was somebody from Web Sleuths who posted on one of those comments, hey, Steve, we support you. We're talking about it over at Web Sleuths. And I came into Web Sleuths to kind of visit that thread and post what I knew and really start just putting out the facts as I knew it, asking for support and help. And the support and help that I've gotten has been tremendous. There's been a ton of really great ideas, insight, and positive feedback. To continue that, I just ask people to take a look at what we know, share your thoughts. If anybody's well-versed in the law aspect of it, you know, covering the no-fault play, anything that might lead us to an ability to get Chris investigated as he should here, I'd ask for that. And just lending support, thoughts, both to counter and to confirm what I've been discussing, all that stuff's tremendously helpful. I'm very engaged. I check in on Web Sleuths nearly every day, though I don't post every day. And I think the community's wonderful. The people who have shown up and shared stories has been, on a personal level, very helpful, and also just trying to get to the bottom of things, integral too towards moving forward.
Exactly, and this is a very good point I'd like to point out to the people listening who think that they can't do anything or don't have anything to offer. Steve, it means a lot to you if you come on the thread about Katie on Web Sleuths and somebody just posts a message of encouragement, right?
Absolutely, just knowing people are there and engaged and care, it has... You know, for me, in the position I am, where I don't know a lot about the process, there's a bit of a gut check you have to do before you really get yourself engaged. And without the support, there's no way I move forward. There's no way I continue to speak out about things and to share my story with folks. Having that support's integral towards keeping, the strength and resolve moving forward. It just doesn't happen without the support.
Exactly.
And even just the, hey, have you thought about this, Steve, or hey, I lost somebody. All that stuff is meaningful on its own, and together it's monumental towards getting to the bottom of things here.
Right. Steve, what is the Facebook page for Katie that people can check out?
They can check Truth for Katie. So you can just go to the Facebook page and then search for Truth for Katie. We have a series of articles and facts. There's a link to the Web Sleuths website there. And we keep up the new stories and new developments on that page there. You can also contact me through there if you wish.
Well, thank you, Steve Wilkins. We will do our best to continue to help you in the search for justice for your sister, Katie. Thank you so much for joining us on Web Sleuths Radio. Steve, you're welcome to stay on the line because we are going to welcome our dear and wonderful friend, Mark Klass. Mark, welcome to Web Sleuths Radio.
Hey, Tricia.
Hey, quick, let's go through some updates here. What is going on in the Sierra Lamar case? Missing 16-year-old from California, vanished on her way to school. What do we know? What's the latest?
Well, we know that it's been 2 months now since Sierra disappeared. Early on in the case, the authorities found Sierra's cell phone. It appeared to have been thrown from a vehicle. They then, 2 days later, found her Juicy Couture bag, which seemed to have been placed in a specific location with her school books neatly beside it and some clothes neatly folded inside the bag. Her mother says that's uncharacteristic of Sierra, as she's not what you would call a, quote, tidy person. From that point on, we went to about the 7-week mark where the authorities said that they were looking for a particular vehicle, a 1990s-era red Volkswagen Jetta with a black hood and a the sunroof on it. Then the next day, they put out specific pictures of that car and asked anybody with information to please let them know. But almost simultaneously to that, they said they had the vehicle. From that point to this point, yeah, that was last Monday, the Monday before last. From that point to now, which is now the 2-month mark, we really have no new information. But what I can tell you, and this is with the help of the good folks at Web Sleuths, this would have been impossible otherwise. We have sent more than 6,000 people out on more than 600 searches, and we have blanketed an area of 20 square miles around Sierra's home. I can tell you that the strain is really beginning to show on her father and her mother and her sister, and that we are determined to see this through. The family has asked that there not be a search for Sierra this coming Saturday because, as Marlene Lamar, Sierra's mother, said, we would like our search family to spend some time with their families on Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, that's so sweet and heartbreaking too.
We really don't know where this girl is, and we're hoping that with getting this car that law enforcement truly is coming to some kind of a resolution in this case.
Well, they absolutely apparently have some good information. If the reports are true that they have the car, then we have a lot of hope there. That certainly could lead to some great big breaks in the case. Okay, Mark, let's move on to Isabel Celis, a missing 6-year-old from Tucson. She went missing from her home April 21st. The screen was removed from her room. Here's the weird thing. When her father, Sergio, called 911 to report her missing, he sounded really calm. When her mother, Rebecca, and her brother got on the phone with 911, they were upset and frantic. Now, some say that this calmness by Isabel's father is very suspicious. Now, here's the other weird thing. Child Protective Services went into Isabel Celis' home, did an investigation, and as a result, has said that Isabel's father cannot see his two sons. That's bizarre. What do you know about this? What have you heard? What are your thoughts?
Well, I know nothing more than anybody else knows, Tricia, but I do know that there was a vigil, I believe it was Saturday night, and Becky, the mother, and Sergio, the 14-year-old boy, attended the vigil, which meant that Sergio, the father, was unable to attend. Instead, he watched it from behind the fence near his home, away from the vigil itself, and said that was really an excruciating thing to have to do. Now, at the vigil itself, Becky and Sergio's sister, Sergio's senior sister, both defended him. and said he was a good man, he was a good father, he was a good husband, and that he loved his children dearly. So the only thing that we know Sergio is guilty of right now is not responding the way you or I might have responded on the 911 call. And I got to tell you, Tricia, Sergio does make it difficult to be on his team. Mm-hmm. He was the last person to see his daughter. His 911 call is not what one would expect in a situation like that. He was very, very reluctant to talk to the media and almost treated the media as an adversary in the first couple of weeks of Isabel's ordeal. And now this business with Child Protection Services, I think that really is problematic as well. But again, we don't know anything. We only know that law enforcement seems to be isolating this man, and we can only suspect that they might have their reasons for doing so.
Well, and the other thing, especially with Child Protective Services, what everybody has to remember, the reason for whatever that reason is for Child Protective Services not allowing Sergio to see his two boys may not have anything to do with Isabel. It could be some sort of, you know, corporal punishment issue. Who knows? It could be he's, you know, falling apart. Then again, it could have everything to do with it. And that's a very frustrating thing. Mark, have you heard about the witness who said she heard men's voices? Her window is close to Isabel. She lives in the neighborhood, I believe, right next door. And her bedroom window is very close to Isabel's window. And the morning she went missing, she heard voices. She thought they were speaking English. And the dogs were kind of barking frantically like somebody was there. And she felt that the voices were very calm. There was no, you know, hysteria or anxiousness in the voices. Have you heard about this witness at all?
I did, Tricia. I heard about that early on. And I have really heard no follow-up on that witness account since that time. The police are being very quiet. They're not really letting anything out at all, except for the fact that they seem to feel that they've spent an awful lot of money in this investigation, which I personally find horrendous that they would even suggest to put a price tag on this little girl's head. But, mm-hmm. you know, we all hear rumors. I mean, the blogosphere is riddled with rumors about what might have happened. But I think one thing that people have to keep in mind is that we don't know about Sergio. We don't know what he did or we didn't do. But we have to remember that a month ago he lost his daughter. And then just about a week ago, he apparently lost his other two boys. So he's in a pretty difficult and a pretty desperate situation right now. And we have to hope that things get sorted out sooner rather than later, just for the sake of all of these people.
Exactly. And you add to that the pressure of the national media. And you have to, you know, you have to kind of give the guy a break and just say, well, maybe this strange behavior is his way of dealing with stress. Maybe the calmness on the phone was just his way of dealing with his panic. Who knows?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I mean, when I was in Sergio's situation, I just wasn't making panicking phone calls, particularly not at the beginning. We have to remember that he might not even have realized what exactly was going on at that point. I mean, mm-hmm. he understood that he needed to call 911, and he understood that his little girl wasn't with him, but did he understand that this was something that was going to go on for a month? Did he understand that there was a very real possibility that his little girl was kidnapped? He might have intellectually understood that, but did he emotionally understand that? And I
right.
think that there's a disconnect between your intellect in your emotions, particularly in these times of high trauma.
Exactly. Well, Mark, give us your website again and let our people go to the website. You have it's a Class Kids organization, and you do amazing work. I know Class Kids was out this weekend at the Search for Sierra, and then also doing a print-a-thon where parents come and bring their children. They get digital fingerprints, DNA kits. It's all free, provided by Class Kids. So what is your website, Mark?
It's KLASKIDS.org, and we will be running our blog off, the Class Kids blog, off of that website here probably beginning this week.
Wonderful, Mark. And again, if anything we can do from Web Sleuth's side, just let us know. You have a whole army waiting to help you. Thank you so much.
Hey, you're the best, Tricia. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Kimster, are you there, my dear?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, now, I'm talking Levi, was supposed to be here, and he's not here. And I don't know where he is. Somebody was trying desperately to call me while I was on the air, but I wasn't going to answer the phone. So this was going to be the part where we talked about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. So we're just going to kind of go over it just a little bit here about what's been going on. Because here's the big thing. And as I brought this up at the beginning of the show, from Web Sleuth's perspective, we need to and will always allow both sides of the story to be told as long as both sides of the story don't violate our terms of service. That doesn't mean somebody can come on and throw out some wild, ridiculous suggestion. No, we use common sense when it comes to posting. Now, because this is a self-defense case, it is different than other cases. You know, other cases we wouldn't allow someone to point out that the victim, the person who was killed, had a problem at school or whatever, because it wouldn't have anything to do with the crime. In this case, all of the information can be put into the scenario to either support one side or support the other. And that's the problem I think a lot of people are having, that we allow people to discuss George Zimmerman's defense. His defense is self-defense. And if it turns out to be true, then Trayvon Martin and his, you know, what he did and how he behaved and all of that will come into play. I've spoken very strongly about this personally. I believe this is all George Zimmerman's fault. I've always felt that. I think he was just kind of a renegade, a wannabe cop, and it just, if he would have done what was asked of him to stay in the car, none of this would have happened. But anyway, recently, or just a few days ago, or maybe even yesterday, I can't remember, days all run together, a whole bunch of evidence was released. We call it a document dump. I know that sounds kind of crude, but that's exactly what it is. Some of the things that we learned that George Zimmerman had all these injuries that we didn't know about before. You know, the broken nose, the big bloody head. The problem is, and this is something that the prosecution is going to jump on, the problem is that he didn't go to the doctor or the hospital. I think he was asked a couple of times, do you want to go to the hospital? Do you want to go to the hospital the night of the event, the night of the killing? And he said, no, no, no. It wasn't until the next day when he went to his doctor. Now, the prosecution is probably going to say that gave him enough time to self-inflict those injuries. Don't you think that's a possibility?
Well, I do think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I am honestly, Levi. I wish he was here because, you know, but a lot of our members might not know this, but I'm not real hep on this case. I don't keep up with it very well because I don't moderate that area. So, you know, please excuse me if I sound ignorant in the case, but I just don't keep up with it well. But honestly, I'm in the middle. But I mean, he could have done that, but.
Just pretend you're Levi, and you know, start calling you know the people you don't like the names and the scumbags, and I love him. I mean, he just tells it like it is, and you know where you stand. You know where you stand with Levi. Okay, now
Ronald Cummings, the scumbag, right? Because
yeah, there
I'm
we go.
Levi, right?
There we go. Let's talk about Ronald Cummings and watch Levi's blood pressure go through the roof when he's not even here. Just the mere mention in the universe of Ronald Cummings' name makes Levi Page go nuts. Anyway, I have been asked here, Tricia, have you tried to invite the parents on like you have in the past, like Billy Dunn? Well, no, I did try and contact Billy, and I got Billy on. I have not tried to contact the parents. I would love to. But they're very hard to get a hold of. Unfortunately, I don't have the ability and the contacts like they do at CNN and such. But I have certainly tried in my own, you know, little universe to try and get in touch with them, and I will continue. I'm talking about Trayvon's parents, and I will continue to do so. Now, the pictures supposedly were taken that night in jail. Okay, but then he went to the doctor the next day. I'm just trying to say what I think the prosecution is going to say. Here's the other thing. Trayvon Martin had a little bit of marijuana in his system. First of all, we don't know when he smoked it, because marijuana can stay in your system for up to 30 days, so that could have been weeks old. Second of all, let's say he did smoke pot that night. That would make him non-confrontational. That would make him more stoned and couldn't care less. So I don't think that supports anything in George Zimmerman's side of the case. So anyway.
Yeah, you know what? I'm so glad you brought that up. That's the only thread that I have looked at in a week. And I said that I didn't think it had any relevance to this case. And I remember when my kids were in school, and they're young adults now, but they said, what, 90% of the kids try pot? And it does last in your system for a month, so I don't think that has any relevance to this case.
Well, and like I said, if it was just a few hours before, then, you know, if it was anything but pot, I would say, yeah, that could make him agitated or angry, you know, any alcohol, anything else, cocaine, whatever. But pot, I've never known anybody on pot to get angry, let alone try and beat somebody up. So I think that, if anything, it helps Trayvon Martin if they can prove that he had that pot in his system that night and it was still affecting him. That's just my opinion. I don't know. But since Levi isn't here to get mad and show outrage and to have blood spurt out of his eyes, we will move on, as we say. Unless, Kim, sir, you have something else to say.
I am outraged. There you go.
That's it. That was good. That was very Levi. That was very, very Levi.
I am really outraged. I don't know why, but I am. He usually knows why, though, so I'm blowing it, aren't I?
Exactly. You have to have some reason to be outraged, Gimster. I'll tell you what, let's go to something that you can talk about with incredible clarity, and that is the Web Sleuth's Hot Cold Case of the Week. Go for it, my dear.
This one I am outraged about, because this young lady has been missing since 1992. Wilda Mae Bonneau, or I think that's how you say it. I don't speak Cajun very well, so excuse me, my friends in Louisiana. But Wilda Mae Bonneau has been missing from Creole, Louisiana since 1992. She was last seen at her family's residence on July 23rd, and she's never been heard from again. There isn't a lot of information and very little evidence concerning her case, but authorities believe that she may have chosen to leave of her own accord. This is what they said in the beginning, but we still haven't heard from her in all these years. So they thought she may have been in Florida when this case first broke, and it was at first classified a runaway, but it was changed in 2005 to endangered, missing, and of course, unsolved. There is a post on Web Sleuth by Wilda May's stepsister made in 2003, and she said that one might assume that she might have left home on her own to escape a not-so-happy situation. So that might be, that again, that was in 2003, so that might be why they were classifying her as a runaway then and changed it in 2005. There was a post made on the Unsolved Mysteries website a few years ago that read, "If Wilda Mae happens to read this, I would like to let her know that he has been sober for quite a while now." So we don't know who he was. But again, somebody was trying to reach out to Wilda. So Wilda, you may be listening to this, or someone may know Wilda and hearing this. Just let her know that things have changed at home. Another fact about this case is that Wilda Mae was featured in the video "Runaway Train" by Soul Asylum.
Oh, really? Now that's interesting. I know that song very well. Yes.
Okay. Well, it's about Wilda Mae. So,
wow, I didn't know.
Runaway. Yeah. Her stepsister has visited Web Sleuth, but not recently. So if you go there, you might not get to meet her. Hopefully, she'll come back and give us an update, because she hadn't quite a while. To learn more about Wilda's case, go to www.websleuths.com and go to the upper right-hand portion of the page where you'll see a little box that includes a link to her case, and her picture will be there too. You can see what she looks like. I hope that we do find Wilda. I think this is a solvable case and a case where she might even be alive, which would really be awesome.
That would be that. I would love to be able to report that, that somebody was found alive. Well, Kimster, thank you so very, very much for all you do. All the guests that came on the show tonight, Kimster, so incredibly managed to get them on with no fanfare and very, very smoothly. Thank you. And you work so hard. And I do appreciate it, my dear. Thank you very much.
Well, I enjoyed all of our guests. And I would have enjoyed you too, Levi, had you been there.
Yeah, Levi, we're going to have a little talk, young man. That's all there is to it. Okay, thank you, Kimster. And we'll be back next week, and our guests are going to be amazing people. As soon as I find them and book them, they will be amazing, I promise. Thanks to everybody in chat. I really do appreciate it. Thank you all to the wonderful moderators and members of Web Sleuths. We love and appreciate everything you do. It's Web Sleuths Radio, where we talk about current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.